a little bit more of an established name. It's a program in Quantum Foundation started by Carlton Caves, Rüdiger Schock, Marcus Appleby, myself, some others, Howard Barnum, who's also visiting here. If you want to find out anything about this point of view that you didn't see in today's lecture, you'll find on the order of about 20, 25 papers from these authors, Caves, Schock, Appleby, myself, and so forth, on the archive at archive.org. Also, if you want to learn more about it, there's a big review paper, both pro and con, by Chris Timpson. You can find that on archive.org. Or you can find two lectures here on PIRSA, two excellent lectures, in fact. Where luckily he didn't really have enough time to get to most of his cons, so they're mostly on the pro. So anyway, this is what I'm going to be talking about today. Oh, let me also mention that the point of view has its roots in the papers of and the book of Asher Peres, so there's still more to read right there. And seems like someone else. Oh, yes, it's also somewhat related to Rob Speckin's point of view about quantum mechanics. So I'll put a big approximately equal sign, because there are some big distinctions between the points of view as well. But that kind of gives you an overview. So anyway, I want to talk about this, and I also want to talk about a mathematical problem, my favorite convex set, or my favorite convex shape, that this point of view of quantum mechanics gives rise to. And I think maybe it's appropriate to tell you a little story of my seven-year-old about 4 or 5 months ago. For some time now, she's been asking me, what is my favorite color? And every time she asks me, I say blue. And she asks me again, and I say blue. And I don't know why she does this. But one day, she asked me, what is my favorite shape? And it really took me by surprise. And it took me by surprise. I was like, I don't know what a favorite shape is. And I just started to say a ball, you know, something round and nice and symmetric. But I caught myself. And I said, Katie, what a wonderful question that is. What is my favorite shape? My favorite shape's Hilbert space, I told her. And she goes, oh, what does it look like? And I said, I don't know. But every day when I go to the Perimeter Institute and I work, I'm trying to find this shape. And she says, well, why do you want to find it if you don't know what it looks like? And I said, well, we know enough about it to know that it's a really beautiful shape. And if we can really get a handle on what the shape looks like, we'll have understood a whole lot of quantum mechanics. So the really cool thing happened about a week later. She said she wanted to come work with me at PI. Okay, so here's what I really want to do with this lecture. I want to tell you about the point of view of quantum mechanics, but then I want to show you a mathematical problem it leads to. And if I can convey some sense of this beautiful shape and some sense of how it may be the case that underlying quantum mechanics is the specification of a certain shape, then I'll have done my job. So what is this point of view cubism? It has its roots in, I think the best way to put it is, a quote that I stole from a 1968 paper from James Hartle. I call it the Jim Hartle 1968 Section 4 interpretation of quantum mechanics. So I call it 1968 because he doesn't believe this anymore, even though I do. And I had to call it Section 4 because I didn't agree with any other part of the paper but Section 4. And even then, I had to suitably modify it somewhat. So this comes from the American Journal of Physics, 1968. Hartle says, a quantum state, being a summary of the observer's information about an individual physical system, changes both by dynamical laws and whenever the observer acquires new information about the system through the process of measurement. The existence of two laws for the evolution of the state vector becomes problematical only if it is believed that the state vector is an objective property of the system. If the state of a system is defined as a list of experimental propositions together with their probabilities of occurrence, it is not surprising that after a measurement, the state must be changed to be in accord with the new information. The reduction of the wave packet does take place in the consciousness of the observer, but not because of any unique physical process which takes place there. It's not like the brain has extrasensory powers to change the world. at least in a local way. Not because of any unique physical process which takes place there, but only because the state is a construct of the observer and not an objective property of the physical system. That's kind of the starting point of this cubism program, or quantum Bayesian program. We take this as our starting point, and we start dotting the I's and crossing the T's and making sure that the point of view is consistent. So I'm going to call this the first pillar of the point of view. The second pillar is this quote by Martin Gardner. I don't know if you guys are of the age where you've read Martin Gardner's books on mathematical puzzles and logical puzzles, but he's a bit of a philosopher as well. Martin Gardner says, "The hypothesis that there is an external world not dependent on human minds, made of something, is so obviously useful and so strongly confirmed by experience down through the ages that we can say, without exaggerating, that it is better confirmed than any other empirical hypothesis." The hypothesis that there is an external world not dependent on human minds, made of something. Well, this is the second pillar of this quantum Bayesian program. So on the one hand, quantum states aren't viewed as something that's external to consciousness. On the other hand, there is something external to consciousness. The world is made of something. The third pillar is the Bayesian program for interpreting probabilities. Dennis Lindley, in his book Understanding Uncertainty, put it very nicely. The Bayesian subjectivist or coherent paradigm is egocentric. It is a tale of one person contemplating the world and not wishing to be stupid. Technically, there's a technical condition called incoherence, which I won't really tell you much about today. But just think of it as being stupid. It is a tale of one person contemplating the world and not wishing to be stupid. He realizes that to do this, his statements of uncertainties must be probabilistic. So probability is a calculus for thought that helps you keep from doing stupid things. That's the point of view. So what I'd like to do is take these three pillars, or these three ingredients, combine them into a kind of soup, and get a picture of what quantum measurement is about and what quantum theory is about. Yeah?
Is this saying that the laws of probability are all in our minds?
Yes. Just like the laws of logic are in our minds. Or you might say, well, there's logic. Logic is not something that arises out of the physical world. It's something that comes before you start theorizing about the world, whether A and not A is consistent. Similarly, probability theory, from this point of view, is thought of as an extension of logic. So logic is what you use when you're thinking in terms of certainties, and probability theory is what you use when you're in situations where you have uncertainty.
Experiments done on people, and they found that people's natural perception of probability,
yes,
their automatic reaction is counter to the laws of probability.
Sure. In the same way that people often do illogical things as well. So the idea here is that just as logic is normative, this is a phrase philosophers use, that you should strive to be logical, and that will help keep you out of trouble. You should, when you're having to make decisions, or you're having to gamble, or you're having to meter your uncertainty, then you should strive to satisfy all the axioms of probability theory with your judgments. So that's the point of view here. I want to mix these three ingredients together into a soup and see if I can say something about quantum mechanics from it. So these first few transparencies are going to be rather silly and philosophical. And hopefully you won't ask too many questions. I don't mind you asking some questions. But then we'll get to some technical stuff where everything, I hope, will start to click into place, and you'll see that there's some technical work to be done. So how do I mix these three ingredients into a soup? I do it with this diagram that I rather like, and I've pasted it on my door at PI. When we think of quantum measurement, when we're talking about the process of quantum measurement, the point of view here is that we conceptualize the world into two parts. So there's the big world. It's just one thing. And when you talk about quantum measurement, you place a cut in the world. On the one side of the cut is something that you... That hints what's coming. On one side of the cut, you put a physical system, a quantum system. On the other side of the cut, you put another physical system, but one that you explicitly describe as an agent. In other words, you take the world, you cut it into two pieces, and you use one kind of language to describe the stuff on the right-hand side, and you use a different kind of stuff to a different kind of language to describe the stuff on the left-hand side. So there's a system, and there's this thing called an observer or an agent. I draw these measuring devices. I do have a big eye here, but I want to think of measurement as an action that the observer takes upon the system. So because of that, I stole this picture from, or some elements of this picture from John Archibald Wheeler, who drew little mittens on the hands to represent measurement devices. So what is a quantum measurement? It's really nothing much different than a kick. You kick the world, and when you kick the world gives you some kind of reaction. It gives you some kind of consequence. So a quantum measurement is an agent or an observer taking an action on a physical system. Because of the action on the physical system being something like a catalyst, it creates a consequence in the experience of the observer. So that's the point of view of a quantum measurement here. The quantum state for this system, you'll notice that I didn't draw it right next to the system. Rather, I drew it right next to the head of the agent. This is to represent that a quantum state represents his expectations for what will happen as a consequence of his actions on the physical system. So there's an action formally given by the idea of quantum measurement, or positive operator valued measure. I wrote Rob Speckens an urgent note this morning saying, do you guys know about generalized measurements? And he said, yes. So I'm going to take that you do. So formally, an action is represented by a POVM, a positive operator valued measure. The quantum system is represented formally by some Hilbert space, maybe a finite dimension D. That's going to play a big role in what I talk about in a little bit. And the consequences of the action are given or represented by plucking one element out of this set and saying, aha, it was EK. The quantum state represents this guy's expectations for what will be the consequence of his actions. Now, when I show this picture, particularly at physics meetings, people immediately have the reaction that somehow I'm saying that the only thing in the world is the observer, and that without the observer, we couldn't have a world. And I tend to get angry after I've heard this 1,000 times. And I say, what about this diagram did you not understand? There's a physical system. There's the agent. We've said we've conceptualized the world into two pieces. If I hadn't done that, I might have represented the diagram like this. But I didn't represent it like that. There's more to the world than just the agent himself, the knowing I. A better way to look at the point of view here is that quantum theory gives us a calculus. It's a calculus that is much like probability theory that we can use to order our uncertainties, to make sure that they're consistent. And it's a calculus that any of us could use. So this observer could use it, that observer could use it, that observer, anyone. It's more like a manual. Quantum theory, think of it as like the Boy Scout manual. You hand it out to everybody in the troop, and they all get some wisdom from using it. The manual was written in a certain way to reflect certain features of the world or society at the time, similarly with quantum theory. All that said, one shouldn't get in the habit of thinking, oh, so quantum theory is only a manual. It's something that everyone can use, and therefore it says nothing about what the world is itself. But like I said, of the Boy Scout manual, the way it's written hints at something about the world of the little scouts. Particularly, quantum mechanics presents us with a calculus for calculating probabilities. We can imagine imaginary worlds. I guess it's a little bit redundant. We can imagine other worlds where perhaps the calculus wasn't quantum mechanics, but was perhaps something else. Or another world still where the calculus was yet something else, and so forth and so on. By looking at these calculuses for ordering our probabilities, in principle, we can get some information about the character of the world as it is without the observer or without the agent. This is a game that a lot of us here at PI are now playing. We take quantum mechanics, we embed it in a larger class of structures, of which quantum mechanics is one example, and then we say, well, we know by experimental evidence and practice throughout the years that we really have quantum mechanics. What is that particularly telling us about the world? Why wasn't it this world over here, or this world, or this world? It's this one right here. So Speckens, for instance, is playing that game in some ways, and Lucien Hardy is playing that game, and I'm playing it myself in my own way. Yeah.
So you were saying that the decision making of a person should be probabilistic for the uncertainties. So were you saying that the probabilistic nature was in the person's head, or was it something, was it part of the external world?
Well, this is a slippery word, I think, probabilistic nature. I'd say that in this diagram, let's say this one, this agent is faced with a situation of uncertainty. When he kicks the table, he doesn't quite know how it's going to kick him back. This quote of Lindley's tells us that if you want to avoid doing stupid things, you realize that your statements of uncertainties must be probabilistic. In other words, they should, in best case, satisfy the axioms of probability, statements of uncertainties. In other words, they should be probabilities. Now, what is the source of this uncertainty? Is it a weakness of the agent, or is it a weakness of the world, or is it a strength of the world that the world creates new things every time you kick in? I'm not really addressing it today's lecture. If you do want to talk about it, I'll talk about it at length. I think it's a great feature of the world that it forces you to think in terms of uncertainties rather than certainties. So, I don't know if that really answers you. I'm saying you can take a lot of points of view on the calculus I'm going to show you today, and some people have. Speckens goes down his own realm. But I'd say the world is indeterministic in some way. You kick it, you don't know how it's going to kick you back, generally. And for very gross, easily characterized, you can't say, look, if I kick this table, my toes are going to hurt. So that's the way it affects me. When I kick an electron with a Stern-Gerlach device, though, that's a different story. I can't always predict how it's going to kick me back. In other words, what I'm going to see on the screen. Yes?
Yeah. Sorry, I know you said not to ask too many questions, but through that, it looks like you're saying that the observer is guessing what the probabilities are going to be.
The probabilities represent his beliefs.
So you shouldn't
think of an extra layer like your language just indicated, that he's guessing what the probabilities are. From the Bayesian point of view, the probabilities just are what you believe is going to happen. It's the numbers that you write down that control how you make decisions and how you make gambles.
But he modifies them as, like, let's say he's doing an experiment with a big number of times during their life. Does he modify his probabilities every time he gets an outcome?
Sure. At least I would. For instance, if I were to walk up and hit you, right now I have no idea whether you think it's funny or whether you would get angry. But I saw hit you once and see you get angry. And I go, well, you know, the next time I hit him, I better watch out because he might hit me back. So yeah, just as probability theory would tell you to update your degrees of belief, your expectations, so quantum mechanics does as well. You'll see a little bit more of this in a minute.
There's something real, though, right, about the probabilities that are telling you how to update them.
There's something real about the things you're kicking. But from this point of view, probabilities are just your own personal expectations, just like this guy said. It's the tale of one person, from this point of view. Now, I mean, this is really a good set of questions, because a lot of the interpretive problems, I mean, the reason this point of view that was introduced by Perez and then later Speckens and Sedov and Caves and company is that we could see that taking the point of view that probabilities are real things, like colors, causes all kinds of conceptual troubles. Leads to things called quantum measurement problems, leads to the idea that acting on a quantum system here instantaneously affects a quantum system there. If you take this other point of view, you get rid of some of those problems. Of course, you inherit some other ones.
but at least to get rid of some of the gross problems that have plagued quantum interpretation. So that's why I'm taking this point. Okay, so just, in fact, your question is leading exactly here. A statement, a satisfactory statement about the actual characteristics of the world, the objective characteristics of the quantum world, should, from this point of view, contain no quantum states at all. Quantum states are things that live in the head. Quantum systems, pieces of the world, are things that live out there. If we can take the calculus of quantum theory and pull two pieces out of it, one of which represents probabilities and only probabilities, and another piece of it which doesn't make any direct reference to probabilities or quantum states, then we say, all of this stuff on this side of quantum theory is about observers and agents, and all of this stuff, all the remaining stuff, is about what's out there in the world. So this is the end goal of the program. But really what my lecture about today is the first tiny steps along this program. First tiny steps of getting rid of quantum states in the formulation of quantum mechanics. So where do we go? Well, we start to look at the calculus of quantum mechanics. In the calculus of quantum mechanics, it looks like there's a deeper object than the probabilities. There's this thing called a quantum state, and this thing called a quantum state has a certain amount of structure. Quantum states live in linear operators acting on some complex vector space. And so it's got this particular structure, this thing called a density operator, or I call it quantum state. So you can think of pure states or mixed states. It's an operator that is Hermitian, has trace one, and non-negative eigenvalues. What I'd like to get a handle on is why have we chosen this calculus? And if I can get a handle on that, then I can go back to this and say, aha, we've chosen this calculus rather than this one or this one for some certain reasons. And from that, I can infer something about the character of the world as it is without observers. So why that? Well, Rob told me that he told you guys a little bit about the various frameworks for interpreting quantum mechanics. And one of those frameworks was the idea that probability theory should be modified. Another one along those lines is that there's this thing called probability theory, and the structure of quantum mechanics is something that contains within it probability theory. Namely, probability theory is the commutative case when all the density operators commute. This is not the point of view I'm going to take. So I don't really fit into Rob's classification of things. Rather, it's this. The probability theory, because of the thing that Lindley said, comes first. So probability theory is like a foundation that we're going to use. And on top of the foundation is this thing called quantum mechanics. So you take probability theory, this is how to reason so that you're not stupid, and then you add some extra structure to it from this point of view, and that's quantum mechanics. So now let me move on to the technical details and tell you what I really want to do. What I really want to do is get a handle on what is the meaning of this thing called the Born rule for calculating probabilities from the point of view I was just expressing. So the usual way of stating it is, given a quantum state and some measurement, you calculate the probabilities for the outcomes of the measurement by multiplying these two operators and taking the trace, and that's your method for calculating probabilities. Once you write that down, immediately you start to get the sense that there's this thing called the quantum state, and derivative from the quantum state are probabilities. These are secondary. Probabilities are secondary. And in the logical train of things, quantum state is primary. You calculate probabilities from quantum states. Well, if we take this point of view that really it's always about probabilities, that quantum theory is a structure that is built on top of probability theory, we'd like to take something like the Born rule and re-express it purely in terms of probabilities throughout, never invoking quantum state at all. So how can we do that? So here's going to be the method. I'm going to get rid of quantum states, just like this, and in their place put probabilities throughout. How can I do that?
Here's the way. Here's one way. I take the Bureau of Standards. I imagine going to the Bureau of Standards and being a good politician And I convinced the guys there that not only do they need the standard meter stick and the standard kilogram and the standard clock, they need to build a device that I'll call a standard quantum measurement. One that I just safely tuck away in a vault and hardly ever approach, really. But it's always there in the background. So there's going to be this thing called the standard quantum measurement. When I've got a quantum state, quantum system, this is a quantum system that I'm describing by some quantum state rho, well, I could take this quantum system to the Bureau of Standards and drop it into this measuring device, and the little arm will go one direction or another, indicating an outcome to the quantum measurement. If by very clever engineering I can choose a measurement up here that is so special that if I just knew the probabilities for the outcomes of this measurement, I could reconstruct this quantum state, then I could get rid of the quantum state completely. So that's really what I'd like. I'd like to find some kind of something that I'll call a measuring device that has various clicks, and I'd like it to be engineered so that if I just knew the probabilities for all the outcomes, then I would know this thing that we usually describe as a quantum state, and now I get rid of it, because this contains all the information that one contained anyway. Well, now let me consider some other measurement. Suppose I can do what I wanted. I can get rid of this, and I have a measurement that refers up here. What about other measurements in the laboratory? Completely different kinds of measurements, like a Stern-Gerlach device oriented this way or oriented that way, or some measurement on a quantum dot, or looking at energy levels or whatnot. Well then, since we knew that we could calculate this, the probabilities for the outcomes of that measurement in terms of the quantum state, in principle there must be a way of calculating these probabilities for this measurement outcome in terms of these probabilities for the Bureau of Standards measurement. So in this way I'm going to make quantum mechanics look more like probability calculus. You're given probabilities as inputs and you get probabilities as outputs. So the question is, what do we need to engineer for the Bureau of Standards? That's the main technical question. Well, immediately you can notice that regular measurements, so I noticed that I had two uses of the word standard. That's why I crossed that out. You'll notice immediately that von Neumann measurements of the usual variety, ones corresponding to a single Hermitian operator, aren't good enough to do our job. The reason for that is if you take a Hermitian operator and you diagonalize it and you look at the eigenprojectors, the eigenprojectors give you the means for calculating the probabilities of the measurement outcome. It's just trace rho. It's given by the Born rule. But for such a kind of measurement, that just indicates information. These probabilities indicate information about the diagonal elements of the density operator. They tell you nothing whatsoever about the off-diagonal elements. So there's no way to go from this list of numbers down to this complete matrix. So standard measurements, in the usual sense, von Neumann measurements, aren't good enough for my Bureau of Standards. What you need instead are generalized measurements, or positive operator valued measures that Rob said you guys know about. So in that theory, have you guys had courses on quantum information yet? Or
no.
Okay. So really, I think you should have had quantum information before quantum foundations, unfortunately. Well, this is a good component of quantum information theory.
Yes, we did this.
So here, as you know, we get rid of the idea that a measurement corresponds to a set of orthogonal projection operators, and replace it with the idea that a measurement corresponds to a more general set of operators, where these guys are required to be positive, semi-definite, orthogonal to each other, some to the identity, and give probabilities by the Born rule. In this generalized setting, it's exactly the same postulates, except for we drop this idea that they have to be orthogonal to each other. So general resolutions of the identity, general ways of writing the identity operator into a sum of positive semi-definite matrices like this corresponds to a measurement. Well, what does this buy us? What this buys us, and most importantly right here, is by dropping this, you'll notice that you can get measurements with outcomes with the cardinality of outcomes, a number of outcomes, that exceeds the dimension of the Hilbert space. If they're orthogonal and we have a d-dimensional Hilbert space, at most you can get a measuring device that has d possible outcomes. But if you drop this requirement of orthogonality for a two-dimensional system, a two-level system, you could, for instance, perform a measurement with 27 outcomes or 137 outcomes or whatever you want, even a continuous infinity of outcomes. So that's what we need. We need this theory. This overabundance of outcomes gives us the possibility of doing the following thing. Notice that quantum states as density operators live in the space of linear operators over the original vector space. Well, that vector space, the vector space of linear operators, is d squared dimensional. So if the original one is d, this space of operators is d squared dimensional. Suppose you can choose one of these generalized measurements with d squared outcomes such that all the operators are linearly independent. Just suppose you can do it. Well, it can be done, and I'm going to give you an example of one in a little while. If you can do that, then now notice this about the probabilities as calculated from the Born rule is trace of the product of two operators. But you can just check that the trace of the product of two operators is an inner product on this space. So nicely enough, you can think of the Born rule in terms of operators as just the inner product between one vector on this space up here and another vector. Well, so if we've chosen one of these with precisely d squared outcomes, all of these operators linearly independent, then what we have here by the probability assignment is the projection of a vector rho onto a vector E sub H. It may not be an orthogonal basis, but it is a basis. And if we know the projections of a given vector onto all the basis elements, we can reconstruct the vector itself. So any such POVM that satisfies this property up here can be the one that we need for the Bureau of Standards. That's going to be nice. So you just choose one. And once you have, you get rid of this idea of a quantum state as a big matrix, and now you can think of it just simply as a probability assignment. A probability assignment is a point in a real vector space of d squared outcomes that lives on this hyperplane, the one defined by the sum of them being greater than or equal, the sum of them equal to 1, and a quadrant of the space, namely the positive cone of it. So you introduce one of these guys, and now quantum states get mapped into probability distributions. It's a one-to-one mapping. I didn't, however, make any claim that it's onto. So what this mapping gives you is a way of taking quantum states as normally thought and turning them into probability vectors, but you can't necessarily go the other way around. So the set of quantum states is a convex object, and this is an affine transformation on quantum states. So that means it preserves its convexity properties. So what you end up with is a valid region and an invalid region. If you pick any point on the simplex on the inside of the valid region, it maps back to a quantum state. If you pick a point outside of the valid region, in this no man's land out here, it doesn't correspond to a proper quantum state. And what we'd like to do technically to get the best possible representation is go back to this possibility and not only say, well, for any such one that you choose, you get a mapping. Instead, we'd like to choose one that makes this shape just as simple algebraically as possible, or simple geometrically as possible. So this is the sort of thing I was telling my daughter about, that I want to find the shape of Hilbert space. Well, in this representation, Hilbert space is represented by a convex body of a certain shape. That's what I'd like to find. So how to make that shape as simple as possible? Well, we think we know how to do it, and it comes about from a measurement that was invented in 1999, independently by Carl Caves and Gerhard Zauner. At least they had the idea of the measurement. Suppose you can find d squared rank 1 projection operators that satisfy this lovely little symmetry condition. Namely, if you take their inner product in operator space, any two of them, you get a constant value. So it's like you know, you've got a bunch of vectors and you want it such that all the vectors have the same inner product between each other. Suppose you have d squared of them. Hilbert space is dimension d, operator space is dimension d squared. Well, you can prove that from this condition it follows that these operators have to be linearly independent. So you can't have any dependencies on the operators if you want to satisfy this condition, and it's not hard to prove. Furthermore, if you take all of these, if you take these operators and you rescale them by 1 over d, they sum up to the identity. So they're a perfectly good candidate for this Bureau of Standards measurement we need. Moreover, they're really nice in this sense. If you have the probabilities for the outcomes of this measurement, not only can you reconstruct the quantum state in principle from the probabilities by doing some nasty linear transformation, there's a really simple transformation. Namely, these probabilities uniquely determine the expansion coefficients of rho in terms of these basis states, pi I. And the transformation is just absolutely simple. You take the probabilities, you multiply them by a scaling factor, and you subtract some. So immediately from here, you can start to get a sense that there's a kind of region here. The reason is, if you take an arbitrary probability distribution and plug it in there, you will automatically get a Hermitian operator, because these are Hermitian. But you need not necessarily get a positive semi-definite operator. You might get one with negative eigenvalues. So the forbidden region comes from trying to keep this thing positive semi-definite. Here's the tough question. Here's your homework problem. Do such sets of states exist? So they're nice. They give me this beautiful expression. I could start moving forward in my quantum Bayesian program of rewriting quantum mechanics in terms of probabilities. But up here, I had just said, suppose they exist. Suppose you can find some. Do they exist? Well, in dimension 2, they certainly do. You can look at the block ball and just pick points on the surface of it corresponding to a regular tetrahedron, really bad rendition of a regular tetrahedron. And that will give you 4 points. Hilbert space is dimension 2. And they satisfy the right conditions. In dimension 3, you can certainly construct sets. And here's your second, your smaller homework assignment. I just discovered very recently that I have a typo in there, which can be fixed. So you might try to fix it. But you can find states, sets now of 9 states that have the right sort of relation that we need. So they exist in dimension 3. Unfortunately, we don't know whether they always exist. Here's what we know at the moment, that in dimensions 2 through 15 now, 19, and actually we've moved on since then, dimension 24, 35, and 48, one can actually construct such sets. It takes some work, but you can construct it. In a couple of dimensions like 7 and 19, you can just guess them, strangely. And there's numerical evidence that pushes out computer searches to be about the order of 3 weeks, at which point this author gave up, that show that they seem to exist in all dimensions from 2 to 67 to a precision of 10 to the minus 38. So a lot of the people who've been working in this, it's been a nice open mathematical problem whether such sets exist, and it has generated quite a few papers. I counted just the other day that there are nearly 50 papers now. Working on some aspect of these very symmetric sets. Most of the papers on trying to prove that they exist. A lot of people believe they exist, but no one really knows. For the rest of the lecture, however, no, and by the way, this is your homework problem. If you can find a proof of existence, that would be wonderful. I mean, I'd make you famous. To the extent that I can, I would. So for the rest of the lecture, I'm just going to assume they exist and see what quantum mechanics looks like under that assumption. So let's come back to this issue of the forbidden region out here. If we can express what this boundary looks like, or another way, a more accurate way of saying it is we have a convex set. If we can fully specify the extreme points of the convex set, then we have completely specified the convex set itself. So I'm going to focus on the extreme points. Well, the extreme points of this convex set just correspond to pure quantum states. Okay, so that's what we need to look at. We need to look at what does it mean to be a pure quantum state in this language. And for that, it's most convenient to invoke this little theorem. This is homework assignment 2. This one's easier than the last one. That I call the remarkable theorem. And the reason I call this a remarkable theorem is not because it's difficult to prove. And I think all of you should be able to go home and prove it, or even here right in front of us, all of us, in 5 minutes or so. It's almost a trivial theorem. But I call it remarkable because, shockingly, all of the founders of quantum information that I've interviewed, I mean, that I've gone up and talked to in meetings, I ask them, did you know this little theorem? And they go, no. And then they write it down. So, you know, you go to the Peter Shores of the world and the Ben Schumachers and Bill Wooters. Amazingly, none of the guys knew this until this fellow, Nick Jones, found it with his advisor, Noah Linden, and a postdoc we have here, Steve Flamia, around 2004-2005. So the remarkable theorem is this. Suppose you have a Hermitian operator. Then it's a pure state. In other words, it's a rank 1 projection operator if and only if trace of the operator squared equals 1 and trace of the operator cubed equals 1. Yeah?
Projector is an operator that's equal to its own square, p squared equals p.
That's right. Now, the reason this theorem is useful for our characterization is because, remember we had this expression here. If I put in a probability, an arbitrary probability, I definitely get a Hermitian operator. But I don't necessarily get a positive semi-definite one. So I could write down the condition in terms of making rho squared equals rho. Then that leads to a whole bunch of equations. Well, it leads to d equations. But you can make it still simpler. You can turn it into just simply two equations with this little theorem, the remarkable theorem. There's the proof of it. Go by it. You can do it. Okay, so I take the theorem and I just plug in the pretty representation that we have from the other page. And you can check pretty easily that the first condition, trace rho squared equals 1, simply translates to the probabilities living on the surface of a sphere of a certain radius. So the first thing you need to be a pure state is that the probabilities live on a sphere of just the right radius. The second thing you need is that trace rho cubed equals 1. That leads to a more difficult condition. That leads to this, to some extent, ugly-looking cubic equation, where you've got some coefficients that turn out to be a completely symmetric three-index tensor, this guy, in terms of these projection operators that we defined earlier. So here we go. Here's the shape. The shape, in all its glory, is written in terms of these two equations. And now it's up to the quantum foundationalists to say, can I give some meaning to this shape? What's the purpose of it all? What does it tell me about what the world is made of? Why has the world chosen to suggest the calculus of quantum mechanics to us? It should be found here in some way or other. Well, so what's the sort of thing that I'm thinking of? And I'll just sketch a little bit of this. As a potential way of motivating these constants here.
So just to go back to the theorem, so like the trace of rho squared equals 1 isn't enough to make it, for you to know that the density operator is pure?
No. It's not in this case because we're not given that it's positive semi-definite, we're just given that it's Hermitian.
Oh, okay. So like if it, because I always.
So I needed to relax the idea that I had a positive semi-definite operator because I know that general probability assignment can lead to non-positive semi-definite. Was there another question there? So here's the sort of thing. Here's the sort of thing that I'm thinking. I want to play the following imaginary game. I've got a quantum system here, and I'm going to throw this quantum system into a measurement device. I'll say this one's on the ground, and this one's up in the sky. I call this one up in the sky because in some sense it's an imaginary device. It's the one in the Bureau of Standards. I'm not actually going to approach it with my quantum system. Instead, I've got my quantum system here, and I'm going to throw it into this measurement device. And for simplicity, let's let this be a von Neumann measurement device, the usual kind of measurement. I'm going to throw it in here.
But suppose that I don't have a quantum state for it. I've got something else. I've got expectations for what would happen if I were to go to the Bureau of Standards. In other words, the scenario I just showed you. Furthermore, suppose I have expectations for what this device would give me if I knew that I had click I at the Bureau of Standards. So a way of thinking of this in usual terms is, if I follow the imaginary path, what happens is I start with my quantum system in some quantum state rho. It goes up here. I perform this seek measurement, one of these symmetric measurements that I talked about earlier. And then when I get outcome I, it collapses the quantum state. And the quantum system proceeds down to the measurement on the ground with this collapsed state. And that leads to new probabilities for the outcomes on the ground, given whatever it collapsed to up here. That's a usual way of describing it. But here I just want to work in terms of probabilities. I have my prior probabilities for what would happen up in the sky for the seek measurement. And I have conditional probabilities for what will happen on the ground given what happens at the sky. And now I want to ask this question. I'm given that and I'm given that, but what I really want is to throw this thing directly in. I'm really going to do this. I'm going to throw it directly in. Is this enough information for me to recover what the probability for getting outcome J on the ground will be? Well, if we were in the setting of regular probability theory, you might say, oh, I saw this in high school. I know how to do this. I just use the law of total probability. I have some hypothesis, HI. I have some data that I might gather, DJ. I'm given these conditional probabilities, and I'm given prior probabilities. And I know that all I need to do is multiply the prior times the conditionals and sum over all possibilities, and that gives me the probability that I really want to calculate. Yeah, but that's high school. That's not quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, we say, it's not going to be this. And the reason it's not going to be this is because we're referring to two different experiments. This is one experiment, and this one, the imaginary path, is another experiment. So there are extra conditionals in the whole picture. The probabilities that we're referring to here are really conditioned on which experiment I'm doing. So what I want to calculate are my probabilities for outcomes DJ, given that I'm not doing the experiment in the sky, condition one. And I'm given these, this is what I want, I'm given these probabilities, but these are really conditioned on doing a different experiment. Ones that, in common terminology, we say they break coherence. So generally, if I go back to this diagram and I delete this word seek and I just say some measurement in the sky and some measurement on the ground, generally, I haven't given you enough information to be able to calculate the thing that you want. But one of the things that's magical about the seek is it is enough information. And you can, despite not having this, you can still calculate this in terms of these. And it's not this formula, but it's this formula. In other words, it's the old formula that you learned in high school, just modified ever so slightly. You multiply that by the dimension of the system in front of it, and you subtract a universal constant, 1, from it. So I would rather like this. What is this? Well, in one language, it's the Born rule, because we could have written this as trace of rho d sub j for the operators d sub j. Instead, here we've got prior probabilities, we've got conditional probabilities, and the only thing that's going on is that we use a different formula than we did classically. Let's go back to the diagram just briefly. If I were to really go up here, get a click, and go down here and get a click, I would, after all, use the classical formula. But what I'm doing is I'm taking what I would have used classically by actually going to these measuring devices, and I'm using that as a component in my reasoning for what happens if I go directly there. Usually we introduce the calculus of linear operators and amplitudes and so forth to calculate these things. This has been the usual way of looking at quantum mechanics before. But now, if these seeks exist, we have a very simple way of expressing the whole shebang purely in terms of probabilities. So that's the sort of thing that I wanted to show you, and it's supposed to be a 50-minute lecture. That's right? Okay. So I won't tell you much more of the remaining details that I had in this set, but I just want you to start to notice the following. A big part of my little group, I've got three students and a postdoc and another colleague here, Appleby. A big part of our group is trying to take this expression and not think of it as something derivative from quantum mechanics, but instead we're toying with the idea of taking this as one of the main axioms of quantum mechanics. So when we ask what is lying behind quantum mechanics, we think, oh, there's a diagram of this variety. And what quantum mechanics is doing is giving us a rule for how to reason, how to calculate probabilities for this, given probabilities for some counterfactual situation, something that we can imagine but isn't really going to take place. So we do our reasoning in terms of the counterfactual, and then we modify that reasoning ever so slightly, and we get the usual quantum mechanical answer. How on earth could this give us quantum mechanics, taking this simple statement as an axiom? Well, remember the forbidden region that we had. If we can get some axiom that gives a simple expression of this region, then we will say that we've got a good derivation of quantum mechanics. How could you get it out of here? Well, notice the following. Suppose that this usual Bayesian answer were very close to 1. If the usual Bayesian answer were very close to 1, then we have d plus 1 times 1 minus 1, and that's equal to d. And therefore, this number over here is larger than 1, generally, well, for any system, because d is always 2 or greater. So that means that this wouldn't be a probability after all. Alternatively, suppose that the usual Bayesian answer over here were very close to 0. Then we'd get 0 times d plus 1, that's 0, minus 1. So we'd get a number over here that's negative. So that's not a probability either. So if you take this as an axiom, consistency requires that this quantity, the usual Bayesian one in that case, can't be too large and it can't be too small. So, ooh, that's nice. But then you say, oh, the usual Bayesian answer consists of these components. And if this whole thing isn't going to be too large or too small, then you find further constraints on these priors, P of HI, generally. So the hope in the research program is mostly in trying to show that this very special basis exists, but moreover showing that the consistency of this as an axiom itself gives us back this very pretty shape that the usual expressions of quantum mechanics define. So that in a nutshell is the research program. And I had some more homework problems to give you guys, but I think since I've already gone over, I'll skip all of this stuff and just try to give you the idea that you should be thinking seek thoughts. and maybe if we understand these structures better, we'll understand quantum mechanics better. Thanks.
I think it seems fair to say that, like, from an operationalist perspective, a quantum system is really like a large class of objects that I've seen, right? Like, for example, like a coin is really like a very, very large number of US quarters that I've flipped over the years. So like if I had an SIC, I could use the SIC over and over again on all these different systems and build up this probability distribution. And that would allow me to get a probability distribution for any other measurement that I could do on the system. But is it strictly necessary? Like, could I have something weaker? Like, let's say instead of having one SIC that I could use to determine the probability distribution of, you know, any other measurement, could I have, for example, two different measurements which aren't SICs, but if I do one part of the time and the other part of the time, I'll eventually build up?
So I think the essence of your question is, can I go back to this Bureau of Standards picture and
And equip it not with one single device up here, but could I equip it with many kinds of devices? So for instance, if we were talking about a spin, so if we were talking about a spin 1/2 here, then I might put three devices up here. One that measures spin in the x direction, one that measures in the y direction, one that measures in the z direction. And then in place of the quantum state, mark it out, and I put the probabilities for spin in the x direction in y and z. And then that does everything that I can. And yeah, you can do that. So I think, did Lucy and Hardy come here and give some lectures to these same guys? Okay, that's Hardy's way of, in essence, he doesn't draw the pictures that I do. But that's Hardy's way of taking care of it all. He gets rid of quantum states and ends up with long vectors, but the vectors refer to multiple measurements. What's different here is that I have a single measurement device up in the box. And the reason I prefer that route for studying the problem is because at the end of the day, I have just one probability distribution in the background. Quantum state is literally a probability distribution. It's not a collection of probability distributions as it is in Lucien's, in Hardy's picture. But it's just a single probability distribution. And that single probability distribution tells me how to gamble on everything else if I have the conditional probability distribution. So it just puts it in a language that's still closer still to probability theory itself without any further modifications. But that's requiring, the picture you're talking about would require me to have a list of three probabilities down here. And then my ultimate goal would be to calculate one probability for each measurement device from these three. They can be done. It can be done, but it's just not the sort of direction that I'm going to go. Because I think this makes it a bit clearer.
But if I had some ideal source of randomness, could I take Hardy's three devices and turn them into a non-deterministic device that would act as...
Oh, you could do that. You could do that. But at a little bit of a cost. Or actually a pretty big cost. So you could do that. But then one of the features of these SICs is they have precisely p squared outcomes. If we put in your three down here, your three up in here, then we would have not d squared, which in that case would be 4, we'd have 6 possible outcomes. Okay, so we'd have a vector of length 6, or if we do it like Hardy, he always throws one away, he has a vector of length 5.
If you're doing a spin measurement, say, right, you have 3, you have an XY spin, or sorry, an X spin, a Y spin, and a Z spin.
Yeah.
Each one of those has 2 outcomes, right? So if you do a non-deterministic, if you pick one of those at random and then do it, you have 2 outcomes, right?
Yeah, you do.
So.
And so you're saying from
each one
of those,
okay,
you can re-infer the probability.
Oh, okay, I see. So the problem is that you don't know.
But then you don't get the right normalization necessarily.
Right. Well, I guess the more important problem is you don't know which one of those. You don't know the XY. You don't know the X probability or the Y probability or the Z probability because you don't know which you picked randomly. So you need to add an extra outcome.
That's to indicate which one you're talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
cool.
That's right. So, there's a lot of overlap here. The difference is the metaphysics also. So Hardy, this is a good question, because Hardy in the end really wants to get rid of systems in his program. He wants to think purely in operational terms. So there is some grand instruction set called a measurement and knob twiddling, and I don't remember all of his terms. And he wants to put them all together, and he takes slices, and he says, where I can identify some things on time slices, then these are physical systems. And this picture, I really want to preserve the idea that there's a system, and that physics is not purely operational. Instead, it's that we're modifying our rules or adding to our rules for reasoning. And it's by the additions to our rules of reasoning that we get some sense of what's actually out there.
Initially, you made a vague reference to locality, you said something like, something we do here should affect something
over there. Oh, yeah. I remember, well, that. This is probably not your question, but I remember now why I said that.
And it's because it says, not because of any. It was somewhere around here that
the thing that we're learning is that it's very hard to come up with a theory with where it is, which is kind of, which is look at still one more quantum world. And I was just your, the way you said, made that comment seem to imply that it was good to use cubism is going to shed some new light on that. Is that something?
Yeah, I think so. And the particularly in quantum information, and a lot of quantum foundations, people have gotten in the habit of saying quantum world is non-local. And most of the people who say that don't really think too hard about what that means precisely. But there is a subset that does. And there's a vocal subset, let's say David Albert, who says what that means is that when I do something here, it really affects things all the way across the universe. That that there, maybe he doesn't think of it as spooky action at a distance, but that there is action at a distance. And if relativity says there's a speed limit to sending signals, or to speed limit to its, maybe not signals, but let's say causal actions, then special relativity must be wrong. This point of view, by taking away all the reality of the quantum state, hopes to get around to that idea. Now, so yeah, indeed, I just wrote an article. I'm just writing an article, and I've got sections finished on locality, but where I try to make the case that from this point of view, there is no non-locality. So what gives is that the world really is indeterministic. When you kick it, something new happens, something is created in it. And if you ask me, what is the import of the Bell theorem? Bell's theorem and Bell inequality violations, it's not that the world is non-local, but that there are no hidden variables. That something is truly created in the process of measurement that wasn't there before. So I'd say, this is what we've learned from Bell's theorem. We haven't learned that there's spooky action at a distance. It's what we've learned is that there's a choice for us. We can go down the path of understanding physics in terms of spooky actions at a distance, or we can say, no, there aren't any spooky actions at a distance, but new things actually do arise in the world as a consequence of our own actions. So I think I was thinking some of this in the background when I said, I think it was somewhere.
It was even before that.
Oh, it was even before this, huh?
But
couldn't have been before this. This is the first
time. It was just a comment you made.
You said you can't change anything with your minds, and then you
Yeah, I backtracked on that because I thought, of course I can look. I can lift my cup. I really was thinking that. I don't know when I was reading it, but I was thinking, of course. I mean, it's like the story of Bill Reuters, one of the guys who's on the Newtonian paper, which, by the way, is another remarkable theorem along these lines. So, Newtonian theorem paper has now been cited thousands of times. But it's not because it is a difficult theorem to prove. It is absolutely trivial. Of course, you guys know by now. All it says is that quantum mechanics is linear, and if you assume that you've got linear transformations, then you can't do a non-linear one. What's he doing? But no one had ever noticed it. I don't know why. And in fact, there's a paper by Eugene Wigner, where titled "The Probability of the Existence of a Self-Reproducing Unit." It's the title of the paper, and he models the idea of reproduction by the idea that a quantum state psi turns into psi-psi. And then he gives an argument that shows that if there are any interactions that do this, they must be a set of measures zero. Well, that's true. But one can go further. So he argued that life was extremely improbable. And then he thought the laws of quantum mechanics had to be modified so that they make life. Anyway, I bring all of this up because Wouters once told me a story that his son, when he was little, was looking at a rose. And he said, "Dad, I wish I could move this flower with my mind." And Bill said, "Well, you can." And he reached out and he moved. And the kid said, no, I mean really move it with my mind. So I was thinking about this.
I can lift my coffee cup. So of course my mind can change the world. But maybe not in a very deep sense, or then again, maybe in a very deep sense, one that physics has ignored so far. But quantum mechanics, I'd say, is not about this. That's what it's about.
Maybe any other further questions you can ask up here. Thank you very much.